Lehigh Valley Public Radio is proud to present HealthBeat, a spotlight on healthcare in the Lehigh Valley, produced in conjunction with the Dorothy Ryder Poole Healthcare Trust and the Ryder Poole Foundation.
Good evening and welcome to HealthBeat, a program that examines how we as a community can create a healthier Lehigh Valley. I'm Greg Caponia, along with Edward Meehan, the Executive Director of the Ryder Poole Foundation. Hi, Edward.
Hello, Greg. Always good to be with you.
Thank you, sir. Today, we're very pleased to welcome the President and Chief Executive Officer at Lehigh Valley Health Network, Dr. Brian Nestor. Welcome, Dr. Nestor.
Good morning.
Gentlemen, we're here to talk about the social determinants of health and how they affect our Lehigh Valley. Edward, could you talk a little bit about the social determinants of health?
Sure, Greg. We've talked a couple of times about how healthcare is extremely important, and Mr. Poole was very instrumental in the creation of Lehigh Valley Health Network and had an extreme interest in the health of the citizens of the Lehigh Valley. We have a growing appreciation, largely from the work of two gentlemen named Michael McGinnis and Bill Fahey, about something called the social determinants of health. And essentially, the short version is that while healthcare is extremely important, there are many factors that influence and have something to do with the status of an individual or a community's health. So the Centers for Disease Control, for example, defines social determinants of health as the range of personal, social, economic, and environmental factors that influence health status. That's kind of a very broad definition.
Right.
But there's some attribution to that about just exactly what percentages of these various things influence health. So as important as healthcare is, it accounts for about 20% of whether a community or an individual is healthy or not. Everyone will talk about, you know, genetics. Well, that accounts for about 10%. So a whopping 70% of whether a person or a community is healthy or not has a lot to do with individual health behaviors. Do you smoke or not? Do you exercise or not? What's your diet? And also where you live. What are your housing conditions? What are your schools like? What is the public safety in your neighborhood? So very broadly, social determinants are important, and we need to learn more about them. And to Dr. Nestor's great credit, there's a tremendous interest in LVHN extending itself to think beyond the walls of healthcare to think about these social determinants that would improve the health of the Lehigh Valley.
Dr. Nestor, when we think about a hospital, we think about, I'm sick, I need to go get help at LVHN. Yet your group digs into the social determinants of health. And as the person that operates this terrific organization, what do social determinants of health mean to you?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I'm kind of embarrassed to say that this is a relatively new revelation, if you will, that is, I said, new in terms of its traction, trying to understand social determinants of health and apply them to the hospital and health system setting. As an ER doc trained as emergency medicine, practiced for about 23 years, even during that time, while I saw a lot of challenging patients with problems that truly had a really negative life path for their health, I really never took the long view of, so what are the issues leading to those challenges, and what am I sending them back to after I discharge them having fixed their immediate concern or medical problem? So, you know, we got on a journey here about social determinants of health back around the era just before the Affordable Care Act in 2010, around 2007-ish. We really adopted a model of patient-centered care called patient-centered medical home, which is a national model where you really start thinking about the patient holistically. What are their issues? What are their obstacles in getting good care? That led to a business, if you will, investigation, as we were having a business problem, and that was there's not enough money to take care of everyone in America. We were, you know, growing a tremendous debt in the country. Healthcare was a deep pocket to go and cut in terms of spending. There were challenges every year about whether or not we'd have enough money left over to take care of our seniors. We always looked at the growing pool of medical assistance, Medicaid dollars, and this was a business challenge for typical health systems that were used to getting paid for what they did in that moment. We refer to that economy as fee-for-service. We looked at that and said, you know, the American Hospital Association is calling for a crisis in terms of affordability for Americans by 2030. As we really studied our local market here in the Lehigh Valley, actually a very prosperous region of Pennsylvania and the United States, we identified that there's already a cost crisis and affordability crisis in our backyard. That led us to believe, to have the following conclusion, that fee-for-service was a perverse approach to caring for patients, and we'd better find a new way. The Affordable Care Act put us on to, which I didn't really agree with, actually, when it was inked. There were a lot of flaws in it, and it goes to that story, the enemy of good may be great. Yeah, it was flawed, but what it did is made us, as well as payers, insurance companies, think differently about this. How long could fee-for-service continue? Well, our conclusion was it'll be around for a long time. The insurance mechanism is a great way to take care of patients or run any business. Problem is, it may not be the best way to take care of human beings and making sure they have what they need to be healthy. So in that effort, we were early adopters of fee-for-value, where we started to look at how do we keep people out of the hospital? And what that meant is, how do we keep them healthy? And when you ask that question, you have to do a very deep dive into what are the issues that serve as obstacles in people's lives. So to answer your question, I now refer to social determinants of health as kind of the following items. Does an individual have a meaningful wage, a sufficient wage to care for themselves and their dependents? Mm-hmm. Do they have access to a house, a safe house, not with rodents or lead paint or other things that can cause health problems, but a safe house? By the way, do they feel safe themselves in that environment with the people they live with? Or are they subject to domestic violence? Do they have access to healthy food? Are their personal behaviors correct? And do they have a support structure of people that just plain love them or care for them, whether that's a spouse, grandchild, grandparent, or even your church, synagogue, or mosque? When you start looking at those things and try to better understand them, you start to better understand why people are having problems today with their health.
Dr. Nestor, you also hold an MBA. When you do your analysis as a physician and a person with a business background, what surprises you when you look at social determinants of health? What do you think?
Well, my answer is probably pretty unique just to me. Again, as an ER doc who was used to rapid-fire solutions for health emergencies, and then adding a business degree to that, it was probably taking me in the wrong direction. Because business and healthcare is fee for service, it's revenue expense. In many ways, it prevented me from finding the solution or thinking about things the right way. So as soon as we started to redirect our thinking again, back in 2007 through 10, there was a discovery for me that the solution for our business was actually inside the mission of the health system, and that is to heal, comfort, and care for all members of our community. If you look at it from a business side, guess what? Our patient direct care shortfall, which is essentially losses, if you will, or as many refer to it as community benefit, which can be found on 990 forms that we have to fill out every year, that number, by the way, in recent years, is over $500 million. Those are services we provide and other services that we don't get sufficient payment for that, you know, is now up to about $500 million. By the way, if you go back 20 years, mm-hmm. that number has been doubling every 4 years. But when you look at underneath it, what component of that is doubling, it actually is the subsidy we have to provide to take care of Medicare and Medicaid patients. Together, that's over $300 million of that. So you start to look at that and you say, well, wait a minute. What's going on with these folks? And when you study those people that come in the hospital, you find that they're many times in the hospital unnecessarily because the social determinants of health have not been adequately addressed. They couldn't get a ride to an appointment. They couldn't get a prescription to fill it or afford it. And suddenly their blood sugar is sky high. They're admitted in the hospital with an ICU stay. And the nice thing is we can fix that. But we send you back out and it's rinse, repeat, and you're right back where you were again if we don't fix the root obstacle, which is often a social determinant of health.
This is very complicated. Edward, how do we attack this problem?
Well, Greg, it's like you've said, what is the surprise, Dr. Nestor? For me, the surprise and not surprise at the same time is we have expected healthcare to stay in its lane and do healthcare as if it wasn't interactive and associative with education, housing, public safety, things of that sort. So as Dr. Nestor is explaining, it becomes in the enlightened self-interest and the mission of the hospital to say, we've got to get upstream on some of these issues, but we don't own them. We need colleagues, we need partners, we need folks that we need to work with that can help us think this through. So as I've said to a couple of school superintendents, you know, we talk about social determinants of health. Education is one of those social determinants of health, but frankly, health is one of the social determinants of education. So if you don't have children on reading level by fourth grade, if you don't have quality high school graduation, you know, cradle to college or career, you are going to have people who are going to have difficulty remaining healthy and people who are going to have difficulty participating in community life. Those are the very same folks who Dr. Nestor and his colleagues are going to be taking care of because they don't have a refrigerator to keep the prescription cold, or they can't have an appointment to the hospital and get there on time, or it takes them an hour and a half and three buses to make an appointment. So I think one of the things we need to do, Greg, is think more holistically and systemically about how do we get our community leaders to kind of think about these issues in a very broad and interactive way. Break through some of those silos. So one of the things that Dr. Nestor and I have talked about is we need to do the community work. There's kind of boots on the ground in terms of talking with pastors and talking with community leaders about how can we know a lot about healthcare, but we don't know about your community. You're expert in the community, so help us with that. So there's a very kind of community-based approach to this. But the second equally important dynamic is, what do we know? What does the data tell us? And there's really not as much information as we would like about what are the interactive effects of poor housing on health? What are the interactive effects on low quality education on health? We intuitively know this. We have some information about it. But how can, I mean, Dr. Nestor's hospital has a very sophisticated IT system. They're terrific. They're really, you know, state of the art nationally when it comes to analytics for healthcare. Now, how can LVHN lead community leaders in the Lehigh Valley to think about how do we take those analytics and focus them on these broader social determinants of health in a win-win-win way to get a better understanding on what does the data tell us, where should we be going with this, and then how do we develop some plans for mutual benefit?
We certainly understand the importance of this. Dr. Nestor, when you mention $500 million, that's a lot of money in community benefit. I know that your group does this, but at some point you have to say, wow, that's a lot of money from a business standpoint.
Yeah, and that was our answer, exactly what we said, wow. And yeah. and it's doubling, and components of it are tripling in short periods of time. And our conclusion there was, so is there something we can do to change that? And you might say, our initial reaction, well, sure, let's make sure we give more care to everybody. Well, more care just drives up the cost. And is it really more care that we need to give to everybody? Or are there populations and subpopulations that we can characterize through the analytics that Ed was alluding to that give us a clue as to who needs more help than the average person? I'm reminded of a really wonderful image from one of our past medical staff presidents who, to try and have me get this as an ER, stupid ER doc, you know, it was like three young boys trying to watch a baseball field from the left field fence, and it was opaque. You couldn't see through. Well, the one of the kids was really tall. His head and shoulders were above the fence. The second kid had his eyes and nose over the fence, and the third kid was so short he couldn't see anything. So they all had equal access to see the game. No one was preventing them from looking over the fence, but they didn't have equitable access. So by finding a box or two or three for the shortest kid, he was up there at the same level as the tall and middle-sized kid and had an equal view of the play field. And in many ways, that's how I look at vulnerable communities in the Lehigh Valley across the country. There are individuals, sure, everyone can go to Dorney Park and get their flu vaccine. Uh-huh. Yeah, but that assumes you have a car. that assumes you have a loved one who can drive you. That assumes you don't have to depend upon the bus. Sometimes our community has to go the extra yard to make sure everybody gets equitable access to a view of their own health plan and can actually see themselves be healthy. Many are stuck looking straight into the fence and are really just are giving up in terms of their health. That's kind of like the image of what we're approaching through our analytics. We're going to identify those individuals that are truly obstructed by social, economic issues and make certain we go the extra yard, mile, whatever it takes to give them access to the types of health care that they need to stay healthy and prevent bad things from happening. That goes well beyond medication. That goes, we got to make sure that we understand not just their economic hardships, but the issues related to the community they live in. Just take COVID-19, for example. We know across the country that the disease burden is everywhere, but it is densest in the inner city populations where people tend to cluster and live together, sometimes in multi-generation housing, sometimes in very dense small rental units. If you look at just the Lehigh Valley, we know that about 50% of the housing units in Allentown are renter-occupied. Renters are concentrated in much smaller units in downtown Allentown, and we know what zip codes they're in, 18101 and 18102. So you can start to identify where disease burden occurs, what are the housing-related issues. By the way, I can match that immediately with the level of poverty. 35% of those folks in those two zips are living at or below the poverty level. 66% of them are living at or below 200% of poverty. And 89% of those folks have kids that are eligible for free or reduced lunches. It shows that there's also an economic obstacle, not just a housing obstacle, in areas where we know there's a high disease burden. How are we going to penetrate those neighborhoods to make sure they have equitable access to the COVID-19 vaccine? That's just an example of some of our daily efforts and daily struggles to make sure everybody has a right to be healthy.
Dr. Nestor, are there any data points that you can look at specifically and say, while this is one that we could get our hands around right now and fix, is there any low-hanging fruit? Because it now sounds like technology and data is truly interacting with physical science. The two sciences are converging. Can you look at one and say, here's a low-hanging fruit piece of information that we can attack now?
Yeah, well, we have concluded a couple things about that. One is if the healthcare gods gave us a constraint that we could only treat one disease, it would be diabetes. And diabetes has so many comorbid diseases attached to it that we could really make a gigantic impact on the health of our local community and our national community. So, for example, when you start looking at diabetes, unless it's a genetic issue in terms of type 1 diabetes, it tends to be type 2 or acquired. Meaning, and how do you get it acquired? Well, how do you acquire diabetes? Many times it's related to a metabolic error where over time, largely related to poor diet, okay, and how that impacts normal insulin production, people become insulin resistant. And as a result, what happens? Become obese.
Yeah.
Obesity causes many problems, including heart disease and stroke and high blood pressure. So we found that concentrating on the diseases and the origin of those diseases and the cause of those and the social issues, think access to healthy foods, we can start to really combat bad things. So let me give you an example where it worked. We look at critical diabetics as having a hemoglobin A1C. That's your circulating sugar in your blood over time. Mm-hmm. It's a blood test you could do over months. And we look at those populations. Anyone over 9 is critical. And you would wonder, where's the population or cohort of critical diabetics that are doing the best in our community? You might be surprised that that is a Centro de Salud, a clinic down in downtown Allentown. This is a population that 2/3 don't have access to a car, all right?
Right.
They can't take off at lunch or they might lose their job, all right? They can't go back 5 times for education, diabetic education in the night. They can't afford a copay possibly to buy their new insulin pump. But why are they doing well there? Well, there's some basic stuff that we concentrated on and found that this is how you do it. You make sure you start your appointment on time so you don't waste their time. You make sure you don't ask them to come back. You make sure there are as many consultants there to take care of wounds or whatever else they might need, or endocrinologists. We do real-time nurse education while they're there. And most importantly, we speak in a language that the individual understands medical terminology. As one statistic last year, you know, we know that of the 54,000 individuals that live in those two zips I previously referenced, about 64% of those self-identify as Hispanic. And we actually delivered over 600,000 minutes of Spanish interpretation right there in the clinic. So my point is, if you just treat a person like a person, like someone you would want to care for and make sure they really understand what's going on, and you value their time and you hear their problems and you get all those problems fixed, people can really have great outcomes, no matter what their hardships.
So Dr. Nestor, you mentioned COVID-19. How do we get the vaccinations into these areas? How do we get the underserved community vaccinated?
When we were talking about this a couple months ago, and I made the comment to our team, look, there's a lot of political stuff, unfortunately, that has, you know, poisoned the mind of a lot of people that this vaccine is not safe. I'm telling you, from everything I've read, understanding the emergency use authorization, these are safe vaccines. I believe that. My daughter runs a COVID-19 testing clinic in Philadelphia in vulnerable communities. That's the job of her clinics. And she's vaccinated, and she's a 24-year-old female childbearing age.
Wow.
That's how comfortable I am that she should get the vaccine, and she's gotten it to protect herself. I said a few months ago, look, success will not be that we get 70% of the population vaccinated if we don't vaccinate the individuals that are at highest risk for the disease, have the greatest comorbidities, and have the highest death rates. So 70% means nothing to me unless we're getting 70% or more of the vulnerable communities. And in our community, again, as I alluded to earlier, we know where they live. We have data on them that's either demographic data, in some cases now, thanks to a partnership with Gateway, a managed Medicaid plan, we're sharing data to know where individuals with real clinical problems are living. And we can target community outreach programs working with local community organizations. Think CACLV, Council of Churches. So many wonderful Meals on Wheels, wonderful organizations that know where the problems exist. By partnering with them, and making certain we bring the vaccine to them. Maybe we have a vaccine jamboree for 300 members of a congregation somewhere in the most vulnerable communities in our region. I'm referring to Allentown because this is an Allentown-ish conversation. But,
sure.
You know, I could say the same
That's
things funny. About out in Schuylkill County, and some of our rural communities are just as vulnerable. So one of our strategies is that we'll be bringing mobile vaccine units into those areas and working with local organizations to arrange scheduled appointments for individuals that may not have an opportunity to get the vaccine.
What would the timing be on something like that?
The first one already exists. We're using it right now. We're using it, however, to help out CVS and Walgreens with skilled nursing facilities, congregate homes, long-term care facilities, where it's so difficult to get to some of these sites. These are not your big manor care organizations. They're going to be taken care of. There are smaller nursing home and congregate living places that maybe have 60 residents, and we're headed out to those places and making sure that the staff gets vaccinated and those individuals, those very, very vulnerable, often elderly individuals, get vaccinated. As you know, our country did not do a good job with that back in last spring, and Pennsylvania did a very poor job with it as well.
How do we compare with the rest of the country?
In what regard?
Social determinants of health as it relates to COVID-19.
Well, I think our local region here, we're ahead of the curve. I honestly believe that. This is in everything we talk about, developing the mobile unit to make sure we're there. We've started conversations with local community organizations to make sure, and we've made it a priority. I think the first thing to do is go around and see how many organizations have said vulnerable communities matter, and they are on the top of our list. They are on the top of our list. So we're going to put our money where our mouth is. As you know, almost all these activities are not reimbursed by the federal government in terms of COVID vaccination. We'll see if there's any new funding. We hope it comes, but if it doesn't, it doesn't matter, because we know by going, taking care of the most vulnerable people first.
So, doctor, how do you pay for it? I mean, at some point, there has to be as a business person, you have...
When you think about these costs, they are not trivial. they're tens, they can be tens of millions of dollars.
Right.
Right. But our organization is approaching $3.5 billion. So we are in a fortunate position to change our direction in a way that can make meaningful improvements in health on a whim. And that's what we're doing with COVID-19 vaccination. As you know, we're ready to do this. We know that getting to individuals just by delivering vaccine at our hospitals will not be good enough. If a person has to come with a walker, how do they get in the hospital? Remember, hospital visitation is shut down. You know, if you come into hospital, you can only come in one door at Lehigh Valley Hospital Searcrest and get your temperature checked.
Yeah,
that would mean a 100-yard walk for someone who can't walk that far.
Edward, what does Ryder Pool do to improve the communication with these communities?
Well, it's exactly what I was thinking, Greg. First of all, when you think about, well, how can a healthcare system pay for all this? I'd ask you to think, and our listeners to think again more systemically. If education attainment is the challenge, that's not the domain of the healthcare system. The healthcare system, as Dr. Nestor is saying, is willing to step out and meet people more than halfway. But we've got to think about improved high school graduation rates, reading level of fourth grade, quality housing. So now we're talking about how do we systemically think about resources that are far-reaching, well beyond the four walls of hospital. What we've been doing, and what, in addition to the analytics and the kind of the high-level slicing and dicing of information cross-sectorally, as you know, is the fact that we're 7 years into a collective impact fellowship. So one of the things that we're doing in cohort and concert with LVHN is reaching out to those 60 or so collective impact fellows, many of whom are at, you know, Conference of Churches and Promise Neighborhood and Ripple Community, and also with city and county government, to say, we need to do the outreach. There are many people in our community who may be a little bit skeptical about vaccine, and we need to think about how do we increase their understanding that this is a severe disease, that they are in fact susceptible to it, that the vaccine is safe, that it is effective, and then how do we make it as easy as possible to reach vaccines? So as Dr. Nestor is saying, you know, if we work with a pastor who says, hey, on Wednesday evening, I can get 100 members of my congregation down to the church. If you can bring the vaccines, let's do it. So I think a lot of what Ryder Pool Foundation can do is kind of help support that communication, facilitate, advocate for this work. The experts at LVHN from the healthcare standpoint are ready to step up and meet people more than halfway. We need the experts on community, like pastors and like civic and community leaders, that we can work with and understand what their challenges are. The other thing, Greg, that I would add is COVID is such an extreme situation, and it's urgent, and it's something that we need to deal with now. But those very same building blocks about breaking through silos, having improved communication, a broader understanding of these challenges from a patient perspective, from a mom perspective, from a family perspective, that housing, education, public safety, income, well-being are all interrelated with healthcare. Those things, those building blocks are going to enable us to address some of the things like diabetes that Dr. Nestor mentioned and other things that are important to people where they live. So getting the COVID process right is extremely important for dealing with this pandemic. But the other thing is those credible, respectful communications that we do ought to be able to serve as building blocks that will hold us in good stead in the future.
Gentlemen, we're about out of time. Dr. Nestor, one thing that we could do as a community to help you on your mission?
Try and look at your own community and what role you're playing, and look at the community members and see who you can help. So much of the good side of health that exists today, frankly, is due to our community organizations. Really. Hospitals are largely still repositories for bad stuff that happens. And then we try and fix it and we try to move on because there's always more of that coming. Today, be involved in your local community organization. Be a volunteer. Help out in any way you can. Some of the biggest heroes I know are in the Conference of Churches and some of the pastors that are around, and also those individuals that are helping build safe housing and healthy housing with Habitat for Humanity, and or members that drive around and deliver meals. Those are vulnerable organizations that only exist because of volunteerism. And there are many other not-for-profits that are wonderful. Contribute your time, help out in that effort, because right now that's driving the improvement. Hospital systems are going to catch up, and our goal is to catch up and be their best partner.
Thank you, Dr. Brian Nestor from LVHN and Edward Meehan from the Ryder Pool Foundation. You are listening to HealthBeat on WDIY. Have a great evening.
Lehigh Valley Public Radio is proud to present HealthBeat, a spotlight on healthcare in the Lehigh Valley, produced in conjunction with the Dorothy Ryder Pool Healthcare Trust and the Ryder Pool Foundation.